Welcome back to the Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Found my mom had a thing for David Lee Roth when I was 15. I had to take her to see, this is my mom, by the way, take her to see David Lee Roth, and Poison opened up for him. And this was when he went solo. Like, I loved Just a Gigolo.
Oh, man. The remake of the old Louis Prima song.
That's one of my, yeah, absolutely. One of my favorite remakes. But that's when that was hot, and his remake of California Girls.
Just Like Paradise.
Just Like Paradise was the song.
Love that
and
song.
And that was the, I want to say he ended the show with that. You should play that on the show.
Man, I love that song.
A young Jacob song. Sure did like California Girls video.
I bet you did.
Mm-hmm.
But he rode a giant surfboard.
Yeah, through the crowd.
Through the crowd and everything. And
he
my mom
rock
was
climbing.
Screaming.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, Mom, chill. Look at the way he moves. Like, I'm right here. I see it. You don't have to, you know.
Yeah, he's doing flips on stage.
No, she liked when he did the splits.
Ooh, yeah.
You know, I'm like, Mom, I'm absolutely uncomfortable with the way you're describing him on stage. Just watch it. Look at him. Like, Mom. David Lee Roth, you know. What do you do?
Hey,
the guy was fit.
Performer. He was a performer.
That's the truth. Front man.
Yeah.
Almost.
This must be just like living in paradise.
Lebo almost pushed me over the rail when we watched the reunion of Van Halen.
He tried to push over the wall?
That's what I think.
Man.
We're up in the suite and almost fell out of it. And he says he tried to catch me, but I feel like he pushed me.
Well.
But, you know. Depends on who you ask.
Maybe he felt bad after he pushed you and then he tried to catch you.
Lebo, confirm or deny when you get in here, please. Now this, you know what? Criticize the song all you want, Jake.
I love this song.
This is a banger. This a banger. Crank it up. Give me some DLR solo.
I can say to you.
The show. We're just gonna listen to music all day long on the Border Patrol. Screw sports. We like rock and roll. I think my mom pushed me out of the way when this song came on. Scott Sharp's going to be thrilled to come on the show at 8:30. After this lead up.
He should be. I hear he's in Nash, Vegas.
Is he? Jared Sutton will be on the show in the 9 o'clock hour. There's a part where he says Susie in here.
Susie, girl, for Susan. Out loud.
I say, yeah, Susie's gay. Susie, listen. All right. The Royals didn't win, and they also didn't lose yesterday because it got rained out, so it's going to be a doubleheader. Jake, as he effortlessly produces the show today, and I say that because he's putting no effort into it.
Well, just enough to get by, right?
That made me laugh. Oh, sometimes
really
I'm funny.
Do you feel like that?
No, I just, you know, nobody...
Sad face.
Yeah.
I'm trying real hard.
No, effortless.
Here.
It's like you're like Seth Lugo.
Okay.
Like this guy's not max effort at all. He's effortless. Some people are effortless because they put no effort.
Right.
You're putting effort, but it seems like it's no effort. Right.
Right? Yeah. The great ones make the hard stuff look easy.
Right. Jake would like us to once again re-examine Reggie Miller's end of game strategy from last night's Lakers Pelicans game. We've had 2 hours to marinate on this. Let's see if it makes any more sense now than it did at 6:15. So once again, let me describe the situation for you. last night at the end of the play-in game between the Lakers and the New Orleans Pelicans, the Lakers were nursing a 108-106 lead with 2.7 seconds left in the game. And they were at the free throw line with 2.7 seconds left, ready to shoot two free throws. Conventional wisdom tells you, make both free throws and the game is over.
Well, that's what you say.
You can pretty much make both free throws and then lay down in a fetal position on the court and let things play out, and the Pelicans can't win. Inbound the ball, fire up a three. All right, game's over, no matter if they make it or they miss it, because you're up four, and there's 2.7 seconds left. There's nothing left to be done if you make the two free throws. But as Lee Corso says, not so fast, my friend. Reggie Miller had different ideas. Let's hear what Reggie Miller had to say about that end-of-game strategy last night.
Here's things that you talk about on the bus as players. If he makes the first one, you're up three. Do you try to purposely miss the second one, knowing that they don't have any timeouts?
They have no timeouts.
And they've got to go coast-to-coast, because as soon as you miss it, time is going to start as soon as it's touched. Or do you just make them both, be up four, and game over? These are things that are discussed as team.
Lakers and Sixers lead by two.
I don't know that anyone's discussing it on the bus. But even what he says, he goes, or make the two free throws, game over. I don't know, Reggie. I'm going to pick the choice where you declare game over.
That's the one I like. Do you think he kind of figured out that he was going down the wrong path when he got to that point?
I have no idea.
When he got to the point, he's like, well, you make them both, and it's game over.
Fine. All I can go by is what he said.
Yeah.
That's what he said.
Yeah.
This is what teams talk about on the bus. Like, what? How many bong hits on the bus before you guys start talking about this and that strategy?
I think there is a score in which that could be reasonable, right?
Wasn't the score last night?
Not that score.
Yeah, see, you're doing all these mental gymnastics to try to get that to make sense. He just got it. He said what he said.
Yeah, but I'm saying, like, I think he... For example, we've seen guys foul up two, which was the mistake. There is a situation when there are calls for a foul when you're up, right? Some people think when you're up three, you ought to foul so that the other team can't hit a three-pointer to tie the game. But when you're up two, you probably should never foul, right? Because you're just giving free throws to the other team and a chance to tie the game. We saw that in the NCAA tournament, I think. I guess I'm thinking that's what he was thinking about, like, because, like, hey, if you're up one, maybe you miss the second one because the only shot attempt the other team is going to get to three, so it doesn't matter if you're up one or two, and so let the clock run a little bit. Maybe that's a strategy that would work. When you're up two and you have a chance to make it a two-possession game, that's the only...
Well, he said it.
Yeah.
Or make the free throws, game over.
Yeah.
Okay, hold on. Let me think here.
Let's play scenario.
I want the scenario that leaves the game over.
Yeah.
Okay, then.
Well, good night.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Make the two free throws and just leave the floor.
Make the two free throws
and then sit down in the courtside seats and drink a beer. Make the two free throws and stand on your head. Whatever. Just make the two free throws.
Well, and that's what Anthony Davis did. Maybe Reggie was like, well, this is a bold strategy, Kevin. Let's see if it works out for him.
Right.
They've chosen to make both free throws and go up by four.
What say you, Pounders?
I think I'm with Nate. I think he started, like, playing this out like this is a good deal. It made sense in his head.
Right.
And then he's like, wait, I'm completely wrong about this.
Yeah, you talk yourself to the conclusion and you realize this was not actually...
Or you just make it.
Where's he wrong at?
Or you just make it and the game's over. So I feel like it made sense in his head, and he probably was just a little confused in the time and situation, and then talked to himself and was like, wait, all he does is have to make this and the game's over. Or you can do that.
Maybe it is discussed on the bus by one guy that's like, right. Hey, hear me out. What if you missed the second
free throw? Hey, coach, maybe, this maybe, guy
maybe,
off the court.
Maybe there's just some absolute moron that's on the team. Hey.
Outside the box, guys.
What if we do this? hey, shut up. This is why you'll never be in the game with 2.7 seconds left.
Kevin's like trying to back him up too. He's like, yeah, they do not have a timeout.
Right. I do not know what you're talking about, Reggie.
Maybe share some of those edibles.
How would you handle that as a play-by-play man, Nate?
Move on as fast as possible.
You ever have a color commentator that made no sense?
Oh, yeah.
Name them.
Nope. Not a chance.
Throw a name out there. No. Initials. I don't know any of these soccer people. Give me initials.
I'll play you a couple funny clips in the break.
Tell me something. Paint some kind of picture.
Well, you know, every broadcast you're going to make mistakes, right? Like I feel like
tons of them.
It's hard to have a perfect broadcast, maybe impossible. So, you know, a lot of times, and one of the things I always loved about, like, when I worked last year, I got to work with Tony Miola a lot. If I made a mistake, he would kind of point over at the sheet, or they, you know, we had like talk back buttons where we could talk to each other that wouldn't go over the air, and so he would just say in my ear, "Hey, by the way, you said this, and it was actually this." So you could correct yourself instead of your partner saying, "Actually, you don't know what you're talking about, Nate. That's wrong." You know, so you wonder if Kevin might have been like, "Reggie, that math doesn't check out."
But it made it exciting. What is he talking about? Am I?
Yeah.
What don't I know about this?
And Reggie does a great job usually. As you, I think you like him as a man.
Sure, I do.
Yeah.
Sure, I do.
But I mean,
not as much as Keith Hernandez, but I like him.
Well, Keith Hernandez will say some things.
He paints a picture, let me tell you.
He uses metaphors.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, that's the kind of guy I want in the booth. I'd like to hear you call a soccer game with Keith Hernandez. I bet he'd say something.
Mark's been getting his tits lit.
Really has.
Oh, yeah, it really has.
See, like the play-by-play guy just backs him up. He doesn't try to, you know, tell him he's wrong.
Oh, boy. Oh, Jake just walked in. We might be in trouble. Are we good? Okay. So making sure.
You guys are fired.
Yeah. What did we do this time?
Wouldn't be the first time.
Yeah, right?
Probably be the last. But, you know. So who was it that screwed up so bad when they were a color commentator with you?
Oh, I didn't say anybody screwed up bad. You asked me if any of them ever said anything that I didn't know what they were talking about. And that's happened.
Who was the worst color commentator you've worked with?
I don't know. I don't know.
Like, oh, this guy sucks. Like, he's dragging me down. What an anchor this guy is.
I don't think I've ever really worked with anybody I felt that way about. I feel like
a little bit.
No.
Who's the most arrogant color commentator?
Most arrogant?
Yeah. Like,
I don't think I've really worked with any arrogant guys either.
Who's been the best? Like, this
Tony
guy
Miola.
Is fantastic. Like, he just lifted you. He was a rising tide, and he lifted all ships.
Miola was great for me last year.
Really?
Yeah, he was awesome. I mean, because he's...
What a kiss-ass you are.
Well, he's a good friend of ours, but
sure
he also, like, he had the power to crush me if he wanted to, because he's a U.S. Soccer Hall of Famer. He's, like, the best, you know, maybe the best goalkeeper in U.S. history.
But he let you fly.
He did. If I'd make a point, he would almost go out of his way to say, "That's a really good point, Nate. I agree with that," you know, or make it seem like he gave me credibility. And me being a first-year guy at the league level, that really meant a lot. That helped a lot. It was great. And he was really big on, like, the first time we did a game together, it was down in Florida, and he called me and said, "Hey, man, I want you to come over to my house. My wife's going to cook dinner. I got a guest room you can stay in. We'll watch games all night," you know. And he really wanted to develop a good.
Are you just saying all this so I can get really jealous of you? Holy crap, happened,
dude. Jake, we have to have some conversations because, yeah, man, it was. Hopefully Tony will come to town sometime and we can all go out to dinner because he'll want to go out to dinner with you. He is one of those guys. And he was the one that told me.
Well, I'm not here to one-up anyone, but I had Thanksgiving dinner twice at Tony Miller's house. So, I mean.
No.
I always thought this man.
Twice?
Yeah.
Dude, it honestly, so after how many years we've been working together, I'm down there at dinner at Tony's house, and he's explaining to his kids, who are all like college age now or older. And he's,
one of them's a stud baseball player.
He's,
right?
He's at Oklahoma State. Yeah. Probably going to get drafted really high. Aiden, he's a power hitter. But their other two kids were at the dinner table, and he's explaining to them how he knows me, and he's like, you know, you remember the guy with the beard, you know, and the kind of the stocky guy, you know, with the beard that used to do the show?
Devilishly handsome.
Right, and the really good-looking guy,
yeah,
the radio guy.
He said that.
Had a face for TV, but he's on the radio.
Really handsome.
He came to our house for Thanksgiving a couple times. And
with my mom.
And they're like, oh, yeah, yeah, and Stephen St. John. Well, that's who Nate does his show with in Kansas City. And I always, to that point, it was this like eye-opening thing. To that point in my life, I thought Stephen hated Thanksgiving. And I always thought that he thought the way I love Thanksgiving was the dumbest thing in the world. So, you know, I just thought he kind of rolled his eyes at our big Thanksgivings. And then I was like, well, shoot, I'm inviting Stephen to my house for Thanksgiving.
I hated Thanksgiving for a long time after my mom passed away.
Yeah.
And my grandparents passed away, honestly. Yeah. Not hated it. I just, it was sad.
Yeah. It just created some really sad
day for me.
Sad emotions.
You know, because I used to be a part of these big Thanksgiving dinners until I wasn't. And, then I realized, you know what, this isn't fair to my kids. And we'd still have big Thanksgiving dinners, but it just wasn't. I didn't like.
Yeah.
We didn't have the same thing.
It wasn't a big family thing.
But like then, it was, and my grandparents were gone, and we really weren't connected to any of our family. And it was just me and Susan and my mom and the two boys. And so, and we used to do a show called Out of Bounds. Me, Tony Miola, and former Chiefs offensive lineman Marcus Spears.
I remember.
And we used to do it at Nick and Jake's out here on 135th.
That's my early days. I used to engineer that.
And sometimes we did it at Talk of the Town, and it moved around a little bit, but it was predominantly at Nick and Jake's. And so Tony and I became really good friends, and we used to get together and watch fights together. I mean, we did it one time at one of the casinos, Ameristar, and me and Tony Miola, was it Kerry Sevagnin? And we had a private booth with a TV screen in there and watched Game 7 of the Yankees and Red Sox when Aaron Boone won it with a home run, right?
Yeah.
And you know, Miola being the big Yankees fan. Me and Tony hung around a lot. And so then he heard me talking about Thanksgiving plans. Oh, it's just me and my mom and Susan and the boys. He goes, why don't you come over to, you know, we and my sister-in-law is coming to town. We got some family.
I think he likes Thanksgiving as much as I do.
And so went over back-to-back years and spent Thanksgiving with the Miolas. And what a beautiful family. Loved them. I remember. So how old is his oldest son? I'm so bad.
He's a few years out of college now, so I guess he's in his mid-20s.
So then, I remember he brought his son to Richie's birthday party at a bowling alley. We worked here. We were really, really close friends. Dude, back then when I first started, I used to host the KC Soccer Hour with Alexi Lalas.
Which is incredible.
It is awesome.
It's so incredible.
Is it?
Yes.
I had no idea what I was talking about. But I was still, you know.
Yeah.
And I did the show with Miola. It was wild, man. Lalas was cool with me. He was playing in Kansas City. And that was when I was like, whatever they asked me. It's a lesson for young people getting in this business. Whatever they asked me to do.
Mm-hmm.
The answer was yes. Mm-hmm. I hosted the KC Golf Hour. I hosted a soccer show. It didn't matter. Mm-hmm. Anything to get on the air and anything to prove any value whatsoever to this radio station. Hey, Stephen, will you host? Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Right.
I did a pro wrestling show, KC Cage Match.
But that was in your wheelhouse.
Sure. But
just
I mean,
like golf.
But I just would. But whatever. It, you know,
yeah, you say yes.
And I did my, I'm criticizing myself because I deserve it. But I did whatever I could to research as much as I could to be able to host the show.
Mm-hmm.
And, look, there's plenty of people that are on the air, I feel like, that know nothing about sports. You know, and they're employed, so why not me?
Right.
And so, Jake liked that one. And so, But I also, it was some great experiences. And I credit that so much for helping me to become better and allowing me to build this, whatever this, whatever you want to call this, career, to where I'm still here and being able to step out of my comfort zone,
mm-hmm.
and do these shows where I was like, oh, I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm intimidated by all this stuff. And hey, everybody, Stephen St. John here with the KC Golf Hour.
I mean,
whatever, you know, I'd rely on good producers or good guests or tons of research, and I got through it, but it made me better. But Tony, and like him taking you under his wing, Lawless was awesome, but Miola was great.
Mm-hmm.
Miola was awesome. And they were always so, and anybody that I worked with. And like, there were people when I first got into the business that I will always remember and hold dear that helped me when I was super intimidated and insecure about my place in this business. There were some people that were complete a-holes to me,
yeah.
and I also hold that near and dear to my heart. and I've got the list memorized,
yeah.
and I'll tell you in the commercial break, and I bet you can guess a couple of them.
Mm-hmm.
But like, one of the first people that, I mentioned these guys earlier, two of the people that were the coolest to me and nicest to me and helped me and took time to pull me aside and give me advice, Frank Bull, Jack Harry.
Oh, man.
And I looked up to Frank Bull and Jack Harry. I looked up to them like, oh, boy.
Yeah.
I'm nervous right now.
Yeah.
And then Frank, well, hey, what do you say there, scum? And I'm like, he just called me scum. And Lebo goes, he likes you. That's good. He called you scum.
Yeah. Oh, the first conversation I had with Frank, he cursed right at me.
Yeah, that's good. Is that good then? And then Frank, oh, you piece of trash. I go, Lebo, is that good? I'm a piece of trash.
It happened right here.
He called me yesterday to give me crap about my broken leg.
Good.
As well as he should.
And I knew why he was calling me. Well, he texted me, he said, call me, you scum. And so I called him. As soon as he picks up the phone, he goes, all right, you're going to give me the Cliff Notes version? You're going to tell me the whole stupid reason you broke your leg?
That's right. But there were more.
Yeah.
Like Miola.
Yeah.
Was awesome.
Yeah.
There's people I'm going to miss, but I'm just giving you a couple of examples. And I was reading Jack Harry's tweet earlier. That's why it's relevant.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I held especially those two in such high esteem, and they were so cool to me. Don Proctor, when Lebo introduced me to him. And like, I remember the first time I went on the road to cover Mizzou in the NCAA tournament, like, what am I doing? And Don Proctor, when I was waiting, you know who else? Al Wallace was always mm-hmm. really cool to me,
mm-hmm.
and would talk to me, and you know, and some people wouldn't, just whatever.
Yeah.
But then you remember that, and you think, okay, at least these people accept me,
yeah.
and will talk to me, and I feel like if I don't know what I'm doing, which was a lot, I say, hey, or Don Proctor, like, I don't know where to connect this to record this press conference. Please tell me. I feel like a moron.
Yeah.
And they'd look right there. Like, okay, thank you. Well, just stuff like that, right?
Uh-huh.
I have a much longer list of people that were kind and people that helped me. And like now, like, and hopefully some of them are listening, there's like new guys or people that are around here that I jack with.
Yeah.
Or I'll have some fun with. That means I like you.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and people might take that the wrong way.
And when I'm jacking with you, it means I don't.
There it is. But I like to tease people, I like to joke, but that means you know, I like you.
Yeah.
I like hanging out with you or being around you or I like what you do. And so, because I remember that always just, that felt good. That felt nice when people would take time to at least make me feel comfortable in a very uncomfortable situation. And I have so many people that I could list and thank, but Miel is one of them. Yeah.
So two stories on that. Since this all started with Kevin Harlan, I think
Kevin Harlan was one of them.
Man, he is a first class gentleman
at that tournament when Mizzou beat Georgia.
Yeah,
and I was walking on, and Kevin goes, "So you're Stephen St. John?" I'm like, "And you're Kevin Harlan talking to me?"
Yeah, you know my name
because he had heard me. Whatever.
Yeah,
and Kevin Harlan was so stinking nice and awesome, and he said something like, I like listening on the radio, and I could have floated back to Kansas City after that.
So when I was a junior in high school, I went to the sportscasters camp in St. Louis, Missouri. I saved up my money, And one of the big things was they were going to have some, you know, sportscasters come and speak to us all and give us advice on our careers. And Kevin Harlan was going to speak one day. And it was the day they were at an AAU basketball tournament. They set us all up with tables and little tape recorders, and you would do the play-by-play of this high school basketball game. And I'm this little 135-pound, you know, junior in high school, and Kevin Harlan comes and sits down next to me while I'm doing some of the game. And I'm nervous but excited at the same time. And it goes to timeout. I take my headset off. And like one of those moments you never forget in your life. He grabs me on the shoulder and he goes, "Young man, you are really good at this. You have a future in this business. Don't give up." And he walked off. And same type of thing. He might have said that to every other guy.
That just sounded like Marv Albert.
That wasn't a very good Kevin Harlan.
No, that sounded like Marv Albert. I said, was Marv Albert
and
there?
And he said, "And it counts."
Right.
You know?
And then he bit you.
But those types of interactions.
In stockings. No.
No matter who you are.
That's not right.
If you're a grown-up somewhere that's actually established in your career, whatever it is, what you say to a young aspiring person below you is going to stick with them. And you can decide if you want that to be positive and encouraging the way Harlan was to me and you, or if you want to be like some of the other guys that cut you down. The other thing Mueller did this would make Jake a little jealous here is I went to the MLS All-Star game last year just to try to meet the people that I was working for, because a lot of them I'd never met face-to-face. And
you had dinner with the 10 greatest goalkeepers of all time or something.
Well, Peter Schmeichel?
I met Tony. I went to the hotel where the whole league was staying. To have, because I didn't know anybody. I didn't know who I was trying to meet, even what they looked like. Yeah. And Miola's like, "Hey, come have breakfast with the hotel." He takes me around. He introduces me to Greg Berhalter and all these like people that he's just on a first name basis with the whole time because he's Tony Mueller.
And you lost Jake when you said that you were going to a hotel to try to meet people you didn't even know who you were trying to meet.
Yeah. So
that...
I don't get it.
Nor do I. Back after this on WHP. Welcome back to the Border Patrol and Sports Radio 810 WHB. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. Let's talk some baseball. Man, a lot of people were furious with the weather yesterday because the Royals were rained out. But then you get a doubleheader today, people. Let's talk to Scott Sharp, Senior Vice President, Assistant GM of your Kansas City Royals. Hello, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. And as Ernie Banks would say, it's a great day to play too, right?
That's right. Exactly. It's a great day
and
to win
too. By
the
way, I love CCR, so thanks for the music intro there.
See, now Jake's head's going to be too big to fit.
That might
the
become
now.
Your theme music going forward, you know?
Fine. That's fine.
You're in Music City right now, huh?
I am in Nashville, yes.
And so watching the Omaha Royals?
The Storm Chasers.
Oh, the Storm Chasers, yep. Well, I'm old.
Yeah.
I'm old, Scott. You have to pardon me. We've been talking about Whitey Herzog, and then I went on a rant about how the Royals lost in 77.
Because he's still
even
mad
though,
about it.
Well, even though I was just almost 5 years old, my grandfather, I still remember him and telling me that for the next almost 10 years until the Royals finally beat the Cardinals and Whitey Herzog in 1985. But that is a good place to start because, you know, the Royals' history cannot be told without several chapters involving Whitey Herzog. And for so many people in this town, that was the time where we fell in love with the Royals. Where we felt, and I heard the words from George Brett that were so touching about his former manager. But that was when the Royals became a thing in this town. And then, of course, he goes to St. Louis, and it culminates with the Royals facing him in the World Series in 85. But you hear so many players talk about how much they loved playing for Whitey Herzog and what an entertaining brand of baseball he managed and he oversaw in Kansas City and in St. Louis. That was a great baseball man that was lost yesterday in Whitey Herzog.
Yes, it was. I mean, whenever you lose, you know, those iconic managers, you know, I grew up watching Earl Weaver, obviously, was tormented by the Royals through the 70s and 80s, so I'm certainly well aware of it. But whenever you lose sort of those iconic figures in the game, it sort of makes you you know, take pause. And at least reflect, though, and remember the great times and the things that he provided to, you know, the team and the city.
That's right. And now the Royals playing a very exciting brand of baseball. And, look, something that's been very exciting. We've been waiting on it. You knew it was going to eventually happen. But, boy, Vinny Pasquantino is on fire right now. The only thing that could stop him is a rainout last night. I think of his last five games, 10 ribbies. He didn't have any ribbies at all before that breakout game against Houston. He's getting on base. He's hitting for power. And he can, I talked about this last week, when he gets hot, he gets hot enough where he can carry a team. Not that he needs to, but the other day he hit the home run, had the double, and the Royals won 2-0. This is what you guys love about Vinny. He's locked in right now, isn't he?
He really is, and I don't know the exact at bat it was, but I think it was in that last game for Houston, or one of the games from Houston, where he took a walk, and it was a much more like Vinny at bat, where he took some close pitches, which early in the season I think he was just pressing a little bit, and he was swinging the pitches out of the zone that he doesn't normally do. And he took that walk, and you're like, okay, he's starting to see the zone and see the ball the way that he typically does. And then I think, you know, he hit that double down the line for two or three RBIs down the left field line. And from there, he just continued to swing the bat the way that, you know, he is capable of swinging it, which has been really a nice boost for the offense, especially, you know, with Salvi missing a game or two. You certainly having your three-hole hitter swinging the bat really well is what you want to drive the offense.
So take us back, like when he was coming up, and then when he first gets to the majors. You know, goofy people like me, we try to find comps, and a lot of people, and there's no perfect comp. You know, he could be a Joey Votto type hitter. You know, when just looking for some to try to explain what he is or what he could be, because he wasn't a first-round pick. He didn't have all of that hype when he first came into the system, but then he just kept producing and kept putting up big numbers to ultimately he forced his way into the conversation of top prospects, and now he's here. But, you know, he got hurt, and he started off slow, and so a stretch like this reminds us of what a great prospect he was and what a terrific hitter he could be. When he was really starting to come on the scene and get everyone's attention, What were your thoughts on Vinny Pasquantino and what he could be and now what he's developed into?
Well, I think the Votto comp is something that, you know, many people have thrown out there, which I think is fair when you're talking about plate discipline, when you talk about obviously a left-handed bat, you know, and just sort of the way he goes about using the whole field. Obviously, you know, Joey Votto has been, you know, one of the most, you know, prolific hitters, you know, in the last 20 years that the game has seen, you know, so that's pretty high praise. But, you know, Vinny has done nothing but hit since the day he signed, you know, and I think, you know, I don't know this, Vinny and I have never really had this conversation, but I think his draft status, you know, where he was selected, put a little bit of a chip on his shoulder because I think he thought he was a much better player and hitter, even though, you know, it's rarefied air to be drafted at all, you know, so, you know, even if you're, you know, a mid-teen sort of selection, that, you know, that's a really huge accomplishment. But to your point, he was not a first or second round pick, and I think he took that personal because of, you know, his ability and his own belief in himself.
So we're visiting with Scott Sharp, and one of the things I wanted to ask you about today, Scott, we talk about the big moves, right? Like the big trades that that everybody maybe notices, but you guys have made some subtle moves over the past year that are turning into what look like big moves all of a sudden. And one of the guys, I mean, we haven't really talked much about is James MacArthur and the job that he has done. He's, you know, he's being put into positions to close games for you right now. That wasn't a trade I feel like that a lot of people were saying, oh, this is going to be, you know, this is going to be a big deal coming into the season. You know, could you talk about, you know, maybe some of the moves that you guys have made in that regard and just, you know, how important those are to building the team that you have right now?
Well, I think without question, what you're seeing James do on a, you know, on a fairly regular basis, not necessarily every night because he doesn't pitch every night. You know, it just shows you that incremental moves, you know, good work by scouting, by R&D, by the thing that was most impressive, I felt like in retrospect with the James McArthur move, is that we had really strong interest, not only in, you know, not in one area, but R&D had interest in him. Our pro scouts had interest in him. Our major league staff, who we ask, you know, on the pitching side at times and the hitting side, we'll ask them, you know, when a potential trade or waiver claim is available to, you know, to dig into some of the data and video and give us their thoughts. We had, you know, a consensus from all three departments that, you know, there is something here. You know, he's not performing at the level that we think he can. You know, let's trade for him and get him here and see if we can make some adjustments. And then from there, you know, once we acquired him, making some subtle adjustments. And look, this all goes back to James. Like, all the credit goes to him. He's made adjustments, you know, as most people, you know, they probably don't even remember now. He had one of the, you know, roughest major league debuts that I've seen, and he bounced back, you know, immediately from that, and has been nothing but dominant since. You know, so those are small moves without question, but they can pay huge dividends, and ultimately it all goes back to the player. I mean, he has to perform, he has to put the work in, and the thing with James, that the more I've been around him, the more that you understand that he's got work ethic and he's got fearlessness and he's going to take the ball and he's going to compete. And those are ingredients that a lot of times you don't know when you acquire a player, like what level those areas are at. But with him, they are at the highest level.
I love hearing you talk about the synergy, though, between the different departments, you know, research and development, the scouts, the coaches, all being on the same page on a move like that. Because just to use the analogy, we talk a lot about how the Chiefs seem to have a consistency within their scouts and their coaches. Like, they know what kind of cornerbacks they're looking for because the coaches, they've worked together long enough that it's like, okay, I know what I'm scouting because this guy right here is exactly the type of player that fits our system and what we like to do. And I'm curious for you guys, when it comes to R&D and scouts and coaches, when you have some moves like this hit, Does it help get everybody clicking on the same page? And how important is that to be able to get all the departments on the same page? Because I'm guessing that doesn't happen all the time. You know, what is that situation like once you've had some success on some moves like this?
Well, it's certainly, you know, I don't want to use the word I guess galvanizes your process. You know, it gives credit, you know, to the process that you put in place. But to your point, like, you're not always going to have 100% consensus each department, but you're still going to have to make decisions and moves. You know, but it certainly gets buy-in. The more people that you get involved, you know, sometimes that can complicate situations, but the more people, more departments you get involved, because they all bring good information to the table, you know, and when you start to get a consensus, when you start to get buy-in from all the departments that they're involved in these moves, again, you get more people excited about showing up every day to work to help mm-hmm. the team.
We have Scott Sharp on the line. So you mentioned you are taking a look at Omaha. It's interesting looking at the box score from last night, the front four, the top four hitters in the lineup, all guys that have spent time in the majors. And look, when we talk about the Royals in a 162-game season, there's injuries, there's ups and downs. And so with any good team, the depth is going to be tested. And it's important to be able to have guys that could step into roles when necessary. So last night, Drew Waters went 2-for-5. And I know that he recently had a 7-ribby game down there. Michael Massey, on his rehab assignment, he went 2-for-5 with a couple of ribbies. Nate Eaton was 3-for-5 with a couple of ribbies. Nick Prado, 2-for-4 with 3 ribbies. And I know Prado and Massey had home runs. So maybe if you could tell me about some of the things you're looking at in Omaha and some of those guys there who, you know, over the course of a 162-game season, there's a good chance we'll see them up here, especially Massey. It's good to see them all with big nights last night.
Yeah, they all played really well. I mean, they swung the bats. It was a very offensive game last night. But as you mentioned, those players, I mean, Drew Waters swung the bat really well. He played a really good center field last night. Nick Prado swung the bat well. He played tremendous defense. He made one, there was one error, but he made a really good backhand play late in the game that was really impressive. Michael Massey swung the bat well. So, again, these guys are, you know, they're grinded, and they understand that it's a long season, that, and if they're in AAA right now, they could be in the big leagues tomorrow. So they just got to get their work in, and they're all swinging the bats. You know, at least last night they swung the bats really well.
That was a big takeaway that I remember from you guys' World Series runs in 14 and 15 is the importance of the 40-man roster, not just the 25 guys. Like, sometimes you can focus on those guys, but you needed those players a lot during that stretch. Do you feel like you guys are getting back to having more of that depth that you need to make it through a really long season?
Yeah, I believe we are. I mean, I think coming out of spring training, we had really difficult decisions. And when you have difficult decisions setting up your initial roster, that means you have depth because you feel like there are other guys that are deserving of being on the 26-man roster, which is good. And really, honestly, whenever we're making moves, even with guys off of the roster that we're potentially adding, it's getting more and more difficult to discern sort of who the bottom part of the roster is. Which again means your talent is deeper and your roster is deeper than, you know, in previous years where it seemed a little bit more apparent who, you know, the back end of your 40-man roster was. That line is not as delineated now. It's certainly these decisions to take players off or add players to the rosters have a lot more consequences because there's greater talent, and you know sometimes you have to take players off the roster, and those decisions are becoming more difficult, which is a good sign. I mean, you know, you want difficult decisions because that means you have good talent.
Hey Scott, thanks for coming on the show with us. We appreciate it, and we'll talk to you again next week, hopefully.
Okay, thank you both. Appreciate it.
Thank you. That's Scott Sharp. Awesome to talk to him. He's in Nashville watching the Omaha Storm Chasers, who put up 10 runs last night with Drew Waters, Michael Massey, Nate Eaton, and Nick Prado leading the way. We'll be right back after this on WHB. Every single time we've come back from break today, Nate Bucati has been telling someone the story of how he broke his leg. Every single commercial break, he wheels around on the scooter looking for someone to tell about his leg.
That's like the basket on that scooter.
And people try to get out of his way, and he'll block them. And they're like going somewhere, and he'll block them. And then he'll block them again. And then they'll say, oh, what happened to your leg? Oh, funny you ask. Then he followed someone to the bathroom, into the stall. It was unbelievable.
That's the worst part about having an injury like this.
Is it?
Every single person. What happened to you?
Chris Mannix tweeted out last night. Of course, this is the lead up to the... I don't know if it's... Maybe it's not long-awaited. For Jake and I, the long-awaited fight between Ryan Garcia and Devin Haney.
Is it bad that I kind of love Ryan Garcia more because of this?
Kind of, yeah. A little bit. Well, a little bit.
Is that totally love bad? What you love, man.
I mean,
I might need you to research this a little bit before you declare this all right.
I'm not going to go full on board with everything, but there's some
please
nuggets.
Don't.
There's some nuggets in this craziness.
Okay.
There's some nuggets.
But if you you go full on board with everything that he's,
then you're probably questioning where I'm at. But you know, there's some things within his rants that I'm like, yeah,
okay,
he's right.
So Ryan Garcia is fighting Devin Haney on Saturday. Even if Ryan Garcia hadn't gone cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, Devin Haney, I think, just beats him like a drum, right? And so, that's my opinion. But now it's one of the most bizarre months of social media I've seen from any celebrity in Ryan Garcia. And his promoter slash manager, Oscar De La Hoya, almost equally as bizarre over the past month or so. I don't know what these guys are doing. I have an idea, but whatever. And so yesterday, to promote the event, because they're fighting at the Barclays Center, they had a promotional appearance on the observation deck of the Empire State Building, which led Devin Haney to slap the taste out of Ryan Garcia's mouth, which many people enjoyed on social media. And so they were supposed to throw the first pitch out, which is just a terrible idea, together at the Mets game last night. And then Chris Mannix tweeted out, "Bizarre scene tonight at Citi Field in New York, where Devin Haney and Ryan Garcia were scheduled to throw out the first pitch of the Mets Pirates. Mets officials pulled the plug on it after the fighters arrived, I'm told by sources with direct knowledge, because they didn't want to risk an incident on the field. Haney and Garcia will face off Saturday at Barclays Center, scuffled at the Empire State Building earlier today." No, they didn't scuffle. Devin Haney slapped him in the mouth. And then apparently Ryan Garcia was telling people that during the first pitch he was going to slap Devin Haney or do something to him. And the Mets people heard about it. So they, you know, and then Jake, in his Ryan Garcia social media obsession, has unearthed this clip of Ryan Garcia and De La Hoya walking out of Citi Field, very angry about the Mets. So Jake, go ahead and play it.
So guys, the Mets just wasted 3 hours of our life to say at the end, we can't throw the pitch for whatever reason. There was no reason.
There was no reason.
And they kicked us out for no reason. So everybody, I'm personally going to say, fuck the Mets. Don't ever go to a fucking Mets game again. Fuck the Mets.
Yeah, there it is. So
I'll bet you that'll keep a lot of people from going to Mets games.
I think, you know, the Mets will keep a lot of people from going to Mets games. But I'll tell you this. Hell of a job of promoting the fight. I'm watching anyway.
It's got you interested.
Now, Jay,
huh?
You're asking me how much it costs and everything else. I mean, last time Ryan Garcia had a pay-per-view fight, your son was watching it against Gervonta Tank Davis. I told you this, the chances of Ryan Garcia completing a fight against Tank are nil. And the odds were still reasonable enough where that was a big plus for my account. Because if you know, you know. And the odds aren't very good, but Jake and I are trying to devise a way to capitalize on Devin Haney, Ryan Garcia this weekend. Perhaps a parlay with Canelo. Perhaps a Devin Haney to stop Ryan Garcia. Until the bell rings, I'm still skeptical that they let him enter the squared circle. But they didn't give a reason other than you were threatening to attack him on the field. But other, you know, besides that, what was it?
I just got a text message from a person from the Mets.
So, everybody, I'm personally going to say, fuck the Mets. Don't ever go to a fucking Mets game again. Fuck the Mets.
Well, here's the deal. If you put Ryan Garcia out there, he might go try to fight one of the players at this point. Go look at his social media over the past, anything. So, which I kind of wish they would have let him do out the first pitch. I don't know. This is me. We'll take a break back after this on WHB.